in Matthew chapter 22, and after the digression last time of Saul of Tarsus and whether he was about at the time of the Lord, we're still in the 12th day of the month Abib. The Lord is still in the temple area, and he has delivered the three parables, which without question the Pharisees and the scribes and the elders knew that he had spoken about them. And so in verse 15 of Matthew chapter 22, we take up the thoughts this evening. Matthew 22 verse 15. Then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. Now you notice they took counsel. Presumably that's the Sanhedrin council. So there were 71 members who got together to decide what they might do with the Lord. If you look over in Luke chapter 20, Luke adds another comment. Luke 20, as we know, is the comparative record. Verse 19. And the chief priests and the scribes, the same hour, sought to lay hands on him. And they feared the people, for they perceived that he had spoken this parable against them. So obviously their desire was to apprehend him, to take him into custody, and to put him on trial. But they feared the people, because obviously it was the time of Passover, there was great crowds and multitudes around the temple area. So they engaged a Sanhedrin council meeting to decide what they might do about him. And the outcome was they were going to send three sets of people to ask him three questions. And they believed that these three questions, which they believed he was unable to answer, would discredit him amongst the people. But while you're in Luke 20, look in verse 20. And they watched him and sent forth spies which should feign themselves just men, that they might take hold of his words, so that they might deliver him unto the power and authority of the governor. So it would seem that the Sanhedrin council selected men who were unknown to the Lord at that time. People who had not actually engaged him in any conversation, who had not opposed him, who was not known even perhaps as being an opponent of the Lord, that they might give the impression that they were just men, that they just wanted to ask him a reasonable question, not that they were spies, not that they were trying to trap him, but they might come unto him almost like someone would come unto a very learned man and ask them a question to receive the right answer. And so they gave the appearance of reasonableness as they approached the Lord. Now the three questions are mentioned in Matthew, Mark and Luke's Gospel. The first one was about tribute to Caesar. The second was about the resurrection. And the third was the greatest commandment of the law. Now these weren't just hypothetical questions. We know the questions well. I'm sure we've thought about them on many occasions. But they weren't just dreamt up. They were real questions. Questions which had concerned the Jews for quite a long time. We have questions amongst us in Christadelphia which we would like the answer to. And we would like someone to give us a definitive answer to some of the questions. And these three questions were those which similarly perplexed the Jews. And there was various opinions as to what the right answer was should be, but nobody had been totally convincing as to what the right answer was. And so there was this diverse opinion amongst them. So the first question was put by the Herodians. If you look back in Matthew chapter 22, and in verse 16, they send some of their disciples with the Herodians. Now the very name implies they were supporters of King Herod. They were very political minded Jews who thought it was right to placate the Romans and do everything the Romans said they ought to do. So any taxes, any laws, anything which the Romans imposed, the Herodians believed that the Jews should submit themselves to them so they might have a peaceable life. Now you can imagine that wasn't quite the most popular of opinion, but nevertheless, because of King Herod, the Herodians held quite a bit of sway amongst the people. Now you notice the subtlety and the way that the question was phrased. We've got the great orator here saying, "I know that thou, Master, we know that thou art true, and teachest the way of God in truth. Neither carest thou for any man, for thou regardest not the person of men. Tell us therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute unto Caesar or not?" Now this tribute was a real insult as far as the Jews were concerned. It was the poll tax. It was a tax which they paid yearly, and all the tax was one penny, one denarius, the silver coin. You remember when the labourers worked in the vineyard, they were paid a penny a day in wages. And it was the silver coin of the Roman Empire, the denarius. It wasn't worth a lot of money. But they had to pay it annually for one reason only: to show that they were an occupied power. It was something which the Romans imposed, not because nobody could afford to pay it or anything like that. It was of very little value. But they had to pay it every year to show that they were subject to Rome. And that really insulted the Jews, mainly because the Romans insisted that it was paid with a denarius. You couldn't pay it in your own money. Now, apart from Roman money at the time, there was Jewish coins about. There was also Greek coins. So the Roman money was not the only money of the day, but you could only pay the poll tax with a denarius. Now you could pay the other taxes in any other currency, but this one was opposed just to humiliate the Jews and the other occupying powers. It was something which had got up the noses of the Jews before. If we go to the Acts of the Apostles, we probably get a good idea as to why they asked this question. Acts chapter 5. It's the time when, you remember, at the time of the apostles, when Gamaliel, the Pharisee, said, "Look, if this is of God, it will prosper. If not, it will come to naught." But when he was given his thoughts upon the matter, we notice in verse 35, he said unto them, "Ye men of Israel, take heed to yourselves what you tend to do as touching these men." He was talking to the apostles. "Before these days rode up Theudas, boasting himself to be somebody, to whom a number of men, about 400, joined themselves, who were slain, and all as many as obeyed him were scattered and brought to naught. After this man rose up Judas of Galilee in the days of the taxing, and drew away much people after him. He also perished, and all, even as many obeyed him, were dispersed." Now apparently this Judas appeared up on the scene, as far as verse 37 is concerned, around the year AD 6. And for one reason which we don't know, the Romans, during that year, imposed another tax upon the Jews. And he decided enough was enough. And so he refused to pay it, like some in this country refused to pay Mrs. Thatcher's poll tax. And he got quite a following, because of course the Jews hated paying taxes to the Romans. And they saw that this man may have been the ringleader to cause them to be able to overthrow the Romans. And so he drew much people after him, but many as obeyed him perished. And so this tribute money, paying taxes unto the Romans, was quite a bone of contention amongst the Jews. Nobody really liked paying it, but the worst tax of all was this annual poll tax, this tribute unto Caesar. So that was the question that they asked him. Should we pay it or not? I expected, I think, the answer to be none. I think they thought that he would put himself on the side of the Jewish nationalists. It was quite the in thing to oppose the Romans. The people hated this tax. So if you were going to make yourself unpopular with the people, you would say, pay it. If you wanted the people on your side, you'd say, don't pay it. And I think they expected him to say, don't pay it. But he doesn't, as we know. Verse 18, Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, Why tempt ye me, ye hypocrites? We've seen the idea of tempting him before and the principle of the hypocrites. But notice, he perceived their wickedness. If you just go up to Mark's account, it's in Mark chapter 12. Mark gives us another word. Mark chapter 12, verse 15. Shall we give or shall we not give? But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, why tempt ye me? So Matthew's got wickedness, Mark has got hypocrisy. Just look over at Luke chapter 20. Verse 23. But he perceived their craftiness and said unto them, why tempt ye me? So it was all three. It was wickedness, hypocrisy, and craftiness. Just keep your finger in Matthew if you've got it there. Just flick over to some words of the Apostle Paul later on. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. We mentioned last time about how it was more than likely that Saul of Tarsus was very much involved in this plot against the Lord. And he was later to say, 2 Corinthians 4 verse 1, therefore, seeing we have this ministry, as we have received mercy, we faint not. For we have renounced the hidden things of dishonesty, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestations of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. Now that's exactly what the Jews were doing here. And he says, look, we were like that once, but we've put those things behind us. We have renounced those things. We know the reasoning of the Jews. We know what their end result was trying to be. And that's not what the gospel is all about. So when we come back to Matthew 22, the master had seen through their hypocrisy, their wickedness. He knew what they were up to. He knew the reason they were asking the question. But his answer is brilliant, to say the least. Verse 19 of Matthew 22. Show me the tribute money. And they brought unto him a penny. Again, just look at Luke's account. Because Luke 20 is quite interesting. Again, he says something in verse 24, show me a penny. And you'll notice, they brought unto him a penny. If I said to you, show me a coin, it's more than likely you're going to be able to get one out of your handbag or out your pocket and show me a coin. But they had to go and fetch one. They hadn't got one. Now, a denarius was probably the most common of all the Roman coins. But there was no denarius there at that time. And that's the implication of it. If you come over to Mark's Gospel in chapter 12, verse 15, he, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, why tempt ye me, bring me a penny that I may see it. And they brought it. Why should they have to go and fetch a penny? Because the Pharisees didn't allow the Roman coins in the temple. And so, if you got any Roman money or any Greek money, you had to change it at the money changers and change it into Jewish coins, and that was the only money you were allowed to give in the temple treasuries. And so they had to go outside of the temple precinct and get a denarius, or perhaps they went to a money changer and got a denarius. No wonder the Lord called them hypocrites. Whose is the image and superscription? More than likely, it was Tiberius Caesar, because he reigned from AD 14 to AD 37. Now, it could have been Augustus, who was the Caesar before him, because at one time we had coins with not just Queen Elizabeth on, but with King George VI. But I asked Margaret last time whether there were any coins in circulation with the old king's head on, and she couldn't tell me, but it was more than likely it wasn't. Because maybe they were all taken out of circulation at the time of decimalisation. But certainly when I was a child, and certainly when Charles was around, who lived under these ancient monarchs, you know, it was quite often to have in your pocket various monarchs' heads on. Just because the monarch died and a new monarch took over didn't mean the coins were taken out of circulation. But it was more than likely it was Tiberius Caesar whose image and superscription was on the coin. They rightly said, anyway, it was Caesar's. And we know the answer. He said unto them, verse 21, render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God. Because we know it so well, we look upon it as a relatively simple answer, but it was sublime to the nth degree. Not only did it answer a question which had perplexed the Jews for many a long year, that even in verse 22 they marvelled at his answer. When they heard these words, they marvelled. And it's like when we have a problem, we've got a question, and we've asked so many people to give us the answer to this question, and all of a sudden we ask somebody and he gives us the perfect answer. And whether you like the answer or not, you can't help but admire the answer to the question. Because what the Master was saying was absolutely true. There are certain things which we have to render unto the governments of this world, but there are other things that we have to render unto God. And the rendering unto the one is rendering unto the other, because God wants us to be subject to the higher powers. And so why? They rendered unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Did they render unto God the things that are God's? That was the point of the question, or the answer to the question. And they didn't quite know what to say. And so we're told in verse 22, they left him and went their way. And although we're not told, I would suggest they went back in verse 15 to the council. Because in verse 23, the same day came to him the Sadducees. So with the Herodians, with the tail between their legs, unable to counter the Master's answer, the Sanhedrin decided on the next question to ask. The one had failed, but now there would be no answer to this one at all. Maybe he'd been able to give them the right answer, or an answer which they didn't want to hear but they couldn't argue against. But the one which the Sadducees had got, there was no answer to. So they would be able to discredit the Master. Now, I don't think we need to talk about the Sadducees. We've looked at the Sadducees so many times. Remember that the Apostle Paul tells us they didn't believe in the resurrection, they didn't believe in angels, and they didn't believe in the spirit. They didn't believe in any form of life after death at all. They lived for the day. And their whole life was wrapped up in trying to please God today, because they believed that the more they pleased him, the greater the blessings would come from him. And so if they were to enjoy riches and long life and all the pleasures of this life, then they had to be pleasing to God. But everything they believed was wrapped up with today's life. They didn't believe in anything after death. That's why in verse 23, the Sadducees deny there is a resurrection. The other thing which we must remember about the Sadducees, if you recall, the Sadducees only believed in the first five books of Moses. They only believed in the Pentateuch. They didn't believe anything of the Old Testament apart from the first five books of Moses. And so quite naturally, they ask him a question based on the law of Deuteronomy chapter 25. We know the question: if a man die, having no children, his brother shall marry his wife and raise up seed unto his brother. Now this was the basis of their belief that there is no resurrection. And it's amazing, as we've seen on a number of occasions, how you can use the scriptures to justify your own beliefs. We know the churches do that very well. They believe all sorts of things like heaven going, hell, immortality of the soul and all the rest of it, based, they believe, upon what the Bible teaches. So did the Sadducees. And Deuteronomy chapter 25 was one of their reasons that there was no such thing as a resurrection. And they would challenge anybody to find in the first five books of Moses any teaching concerning resurrection. We're going to test your knowledge of the first five books of Moses in a minute. We'll go around the room and ask the questions. Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 5. If brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no child, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her, and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of her husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which he beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. Now that law was rigidly adhered to, and the next of kin, the near kinsman, would always raise up seed unto the previous relative. Why? Why should God institute such a law if it wasn't to support the need of this life? If there was such a thing as resurrection of the dead, why would it be so important to continue the generations as far as this life is concerned? Because if your hope was in the future, what did it matter if a person was childless or not? Their hope would be in the future. And they've got a very, very, very good quotation which they used to support their argument. Genesis 38. Now I'm sure we appreciate that although the law was formalised here in Deuteronomy 25, like a lot of things in the book of Genesis which were formalised later in the law of Moses, they actually had been a reality during the time of the patriarchs. And Genesis 38 is that sad incident concerning Judah. And if you remember, we'll just take up the point from verse 1. It came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned to a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he took her and went unto her. And she conceived and bare a son and called his name Er. And she conceived again and bare a son and called his name Onah. And she yet again conceived and bare a son and called his name Shelah. And he was at Chezib when she bare him. And Judah took a wife for Er his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. And Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord slew him. And Judah said to Onan, who was the second son, go in unto the brother's wife, and marry her, and raise up seed to thy brother. And Onan knew that his seed should not be his. And it came to pass, when he went in unto his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground, lest he should give seed unto his brother. The thing displeased the Lord, and he was slain. So here was Judah practicing what became later a formal law, that it was necessary for a woman, if her husband died and she was childless, then the next of kin would go in unto her. And there in verse 8 was the crux of the argument of the Sadducees. Judah said unto Onan, go into thy unto thy brother's wife and marry her and raise up. And in the Greek, we'll understand what that means. If you look at the Septuagint, you will see the Greek word there for raised up is anastasis. 1 Corinthians 15, when Paul talks of being raised up from the dead, it's anastasis. So the very basis of resurrection is a raising up, a rising up. And they said the only raising up is the procreation of the human race. So when God talks about resurrection, he's talking about a new birth, the next in line. A child is born. That's quite a subtle argument, really. Because why should God formulate such a law if there was such a thing as a future hope and resurrection? That was their argument. And you've got to find an answer to that argument from the first five books of Moses. Because anything else would have been dismissed. Now we could go to the Psalms, we could go to Daniel, we could go to Job, we could go to other places in the Old Testament scriptures where it speaks abundantly of resurrection. But we've got five books to choose from. And the Lord had got to disprove their argument. I hope none of you are hot, but I'm cold, so. Thank you. So they bring this hypothetical situation. I mean, it's a bit illogical. I think by the time you come to the third husband, he'd think, well, this is a bit of a sad case. And it seems unlikely that you'd get to seven husbands. But nevertheless, such was their pathetic argument. Verse 27, last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be of the seven? For they all had her. As I said earlier on, these were real questions. This was the Sadducees' argument against the Pharisees who believed in the resurrection. And the Pharisee had got an answer to this question. They said the first husband was the real and only husband. So in the resurrection, she would go back to the first husband. That was their answer. But it wasn't very convincing, because you could make all sorts of problems then. What happened to the other six? And so on and so forth. And so they weren't convinced at all. Now, in verse 29, Jesus answered and said unto them, you do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. That's quite a statement. Because if they believed, which they did, only in the first five books of Moses, Jesus said their argument, which they had put question, was illogical, because they didn't understand the very scriptures they were quoting from. Now we know, in hindsight, that resurrection demands the power of God. And of course we have to believe in the scriptures to accept the principle of resurrection. But from their point of view, he was rebuking them because their argument was not based and established from the first five books of Moses. So he now goes on to explain it. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. Bear in mind, Sadducees didn't believe in angels either. Now you can counter that one very easily. Genesis 19. The angels who came to Abraham to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Exodus 17. when God promised that Michael would go before Israel, his name would be in him to lead Israel into the promised land. You could go to Exodus 33, is it, or 34, after the incident of the golden calf, when Moses had broken the tablets of stone, and God said he was going to withdraw the presence of his angel. And Moses says, look, if your presence is not going with us in the form of the angel, then we don't want to go. So there is many a place in the first five books where you could argue concerning angels. And now the Master says, in the resurrection, they will be like unto the angels, they will neither marry nor are given in marriage. So what he was saying, the law of Deuteronomy 25 only applied to this life as far as the procreation of seed was concerned. Because in the future, there will be no purpose whatsoever marriage, but they which shall be accounted worthy to obtain that world and the resurrection from the dead, neither marry nor are given in marriage, neither can they die any more, for they are equal unto the angels as the children of God, being the children of the resurrection. Again, first of all, he is saying the reason why we marry and children are born today, verse 34, because of the continuance as far as this world is concerned. But in verse 35, not everybody, but those who are accounted worthy to obtain the resurrection from the dead won't have that need. They won't need to marry or give in marriage for the procreation of the race, because they don't die anymore. That's his answer. And now comes his proof. Verse 37. Now that the dead are raised, even Moses showed at the bush, when he calleth the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, he is not the God of the dead, but of the living. For all live unto him. Now we know the churches have tried to suggest the Lord is saying that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are still alive in heaven, because that's what the Master was quoting. Of course, he's disputed that already, because he's told us in verse 35 about those who are raised from the dead. We can look at it from an understanding of the truth. So what did the Master mean when he quotes Exodus chapter 3? Well, if we go back to Exodus chapter 3, I think we'll see the power of it. Again, we know the quotation well, but let's see how the Master applies it. The actual quotation which the Master uses is Exodus chapter 3 and verse 6. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now, after the memorial name was given, in verse 15, God moreover said unto Moses, Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me unto you. This is my name for ever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together, and say unto them, The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you, and have seen that which is done unto you in Egypt. I have said, I will bring you out of Egypt, and I will bring you into the land. Now, at the end of verse 26, we know where he's quoting from. He's quoting from the book of Genesis in chapter 50, as far as the promise to Joseph was concerned. But when we go forward to Exodus chapter 6, God now gives us an understanding of why he is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and of Jacob. Look at verse 3. I appeared unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob by the name of El Shaddai, God Almighty, but by my name Yahweh was I not known to them. And then in verse 5 he says, I've also heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage, and I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore say unto the children of Israel, I am the Lord, I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians, I will rid you out of their bondage, and I will redeem you with a stretched out arm and with great judgment. And I will take you to me for a people, I will be to you a God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God, which bringeth you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. Would the Sadducees have any argument with that? The answer is no, because the proof of it is seen in what God does as far as his people were concerned in Egypt. Now comes the crunch. And I will bring you into the land concerning the which I did swear to give it to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and I will give it to you for inheritance. So the very promise which told that God would bring his people out of the land of Egypt was the same promise that he gave to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, that he would give to them the land to inherit. But if they were dead, how could they inherit the land? The only way they could inherit the land was by resurrection from the dead. As we've said on many, many occasions, what we have in the Gospels is only an appraisal of what the Lord said. If everything was written, the world couldn't contain the books. We thankfully have the help of the Apostle Paul. Go to Romans chapter 4, and he uses exactly the same argument concerning the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. Remember, this is the occasion when he talks about Abraham being justified by faith. Verse 13 of Romans 4. For the promise that he should be heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. Verse 17. As it is written, I have made thee, Abraham, a father of many nations, before him whom he believed, even God, which quickeneth the dead, and calleth those things which be not as though they were, who against hope believed in hope, that he might become the father of many nations, according to all that which was spoken, so shall thy seed be. So Abraham was promised that he would be a father of many nations, that he would inherit the promises that God had made unto him. How could God promise to Abraham that he would do that? Because the end of verse 17, God calleth those things which be not as though they were. So when he made the promise to Abraham, although we've got a period of 4,000 years before they'll be fulfilled, it was as good as it was happening, because God knew that it would happen. Notice Paul's comment, who quickeneth the dead. And so Paul quotes the very fact of the promises made to Abraham as being the very basis of resurrection from the dead. Because how could Abraham, Isaac, Jacob inherit the promises unless they were raised from the dead? That's why, of course, there is great play made in Stephen's defence and other places concerning the cave of Machpelah, the places where the fathers were buried. Remember another occasion, they said, look, go and see David's sepulchre. It's there. David's not ascended to the heavens. He's dead and he was buried. And so the only way these fathers could inherit the promises was to be raised from the dead. And so when we come back to Matthew 22... that's exactly the argument which the Master is saying. If you understand the first five books, they're all based concerning the promises made to Abraham. God would cause his people to go into Egypt, but he would bring them out of Egypt, and he would give them an inheritance in the land. That's what was promised, not only to the seed, but to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as well. So that means he must be the God of the living, not of the dead. Otherwise, the promises are of non-effect. And so in verse 33, when the multitudes heard this, they were astonished at his doctrine. And so that put to flight the Sadducees. There was no argument against it, because he based his argument against the first five books of Moses, against the great promises which they held in great reverence and awe, and the very fact that God had promised the land and the fulfillment of the promises to the fathers of old made them realize that the resurrection of dead must be the very cornerstone of those promises. Now we've got a bit of one-upmanship. Look at verse 34. Now comes the third question. The first one had been a question of politics. The second one had been a question of doctrine. Now comes a question of law. Verse 34. When the Pharisees had heard that he had put the Sadducees to silence, they were gathered together. Then one of them said, which was a lawyer, they put him a question, tempting him and saying, "Master, which is the great commandment in the law?" Now again, we're very familiar with not only the question but the answer. But to them, it was an imponderable one. They've got 10 great laws. They've got other statutes. They've got other laws which God had placed upon them. They've got their own interpretations and traditions of those laws. And there was great argument, which was the greatest of them all. Now, we've got laws. And we mustn't think that all laws of God are to be treated as equal. Some laws are greater importance than others. Giving an instance. We mentioned earlier that one of the laws is that we should be subject to the higher powers. We should render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. So as far as the governments of this world are concerned, we are told they are God's ministers and we are to be subject to them, so that we can live peaceably with all men. If you want the laws, I'm sure you know, it's in Romans and other places, it's the laws which are placed upon us. But if that government says, "We've got a war on our hands, we want you to fight," another law says, "Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not strive." We've got two laws, the one in conflict with the other. One says we should obey the authorities, the other one says, but we can't do what they're asking us to do. So one law supersedes another. So there is an importance attached to all the laws that we have been given. Some laws are greater in importance and significance, and must be adhered to at all costs, where others can be overruled by more important laws. So you take the 10 laws of the commandments. Which would have been the greatest of them all? Just think, as far as the Jews were concerned at this time, and still the traditional Jews today, the Torah was everything. But of those 10, which was the greatest? And there was as many answers as, no doubt, divisions amongst the Pharisees. And so we know what the Master's answer was. Which is the great commandment of the law? Jesus said in verse 37, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment." Now we know, because we've got it marked up in our Bibles, I'm sure, where that quotation was. It's from Deuteronomy chapter 6. Now bear in mind, the book Deuteronomy is the second law. It was the law which was given just as the children of Israel were to move into the land of Israel. It was given during the last 12 months of the life of Moses. And so it was a repetition of the law which had been given at Sinai. And so in verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, The Lord our God is one Lord, and thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. That was the quotation which the Master used. And these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thine house, when thou walkest by the way, when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. And thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and there shall be as frontlets between thine eyes. And thou shalt write them upon the posts of thy house and upon thy gates. And so the Lord, in answering the Pharisees' question, says, that's the greatest commandment there. The phylactery which is upon your head said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. It's still in their phylacteries today. It's still on the doorposts of all the Jewish hotels. You can't go into a house amongst the Israelis without a phylactery being upon the doorpost, which bears the inscription, thou shalt love the Lord thy God. The Lord our God is one Lord. Now, what the Master was doing, because I doubt if any would have got it from Deuteronomy chapter 6, he was saying that Deuteronomy chapter 6 is the summing up of the first five laws of the Ten Commandments, those which appertained to God. So the Ten Commandments is split down into two fives. The first five, the loving of the Lord thy God. And the second, as we know in Matthew 22, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. On these two laws hang all the law and the prophets, or on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. If you go to Leviticus 19, we've seen this again on previous occasions, and we're going to see over the next couple of days of the Lord's life a lot of repetition so that we might learn the lessons. Verse 18 is where the Master quotes from. Thou shalt not avenge, Leviticus 19, verse 18. Thou shalt not avenge nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. Now, as we know, in that one phrase, the Master sums up the last five of the Ten Commandments, man's responsibility to his fellow man. So the first responsibility is to God, the second is to man. Very simple, straightforward, but to them it was totally profound. It's something we've become accustomed to because we understand what the Lord had said. But in those days, no man had ever given an answer like that. It's interesting, we will go to the Epistle of James, that James makes a comment you might like to ponder. James in chapter 2 is talking about don't be a respecter of persons, because God's no respecter of persons. And obviously that was a great problem amongst the Jewish brethren and sisters, that the Gentiles could be accepted on the same basis. So we know there was a problem of respecter of persons. In verse 5 of James 2, hearken, my beloved brethren, hath not God chosen the poor of this world rich in faith, which he hath promised to them that love him? But you have despised the poor. Do not men, rich men oppress you and draw you before the judgment seats? Do they not blaspheme that worthy name by which you are called? If you fulfil the royal law according to the scripture, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself, you do well. So James quotes the second of the Master's answers, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself, where he sums up the last five of the Ten Commandments as the royal law. I've often wondered why he calls it the royal law, because the whole of the law was royal. But he quotes that the royal law. And I just wonder, and again, purely a suggestion, whether James calls it the royal law because in Matthew 25, which we're going to consider in a few weeks, God willing, when the Master speaks about the king who sits upon the throne of his glory, And he says, as you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. We've got a king who tells us that we should treat our fellow man rightly. If he's naked, you clothe him. If he's hungry, you feed him. So if it's from a king, it's a royal law, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. I just wonder if James has got that in mind. If he hasn't, then there is something based upon the actual law of the last five of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself, which qualifies it as the royal law. So I'd be interested if you have any comments in a bit. So let's come back to Matthew 22. Verse 14, Matthew 22, these two things which the Master has spoken sums up all the law of the prophets. And when you think about it, it's totally logical, totally true. Everything either had to do with God or fellow man. There's no law which had nothing to do with either. And so it summed up completely all what the law had taught. But if we go to Luke's account, Luke chapter 20, this is what verse 39, the scribe answered. Master, he says, thou hast well said. And after that, they did not ask him any question at all. They had taken counsel. They thought that these would trap the master. They tried to give the appearance of reasonableness as asking a genuine, honest question. He saw through their hypocrisy and he gave some sublime, superb answers which they couldn't now counter. So no man could ask him any more questions. So he posed one for them. Verse 41. He said unto them, how say they that Christ is David's son? David himself said in the book of Psalms, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand, till I make thine enemies thy footstool. David therefore calleth him Lord. How is he then his son? Now again, we're so familiar with the question that we sometimes forget the point the Lord was making. He'd established, as he'd rode into Jerusalem, as he'd done all the things on the 10th and the 11th day of the month Abib, that he was the Messiah of Israel. They asked him, by what authority do you claim to be your Messiah? Is it of God or of man? The Lord then gave the three parables to prove that it was of God. They perceived that in those parables he was having a go at them. Now they'd ask him the questions and he'd give them the answers. Could they deny that he was a son of David? Answer? No. Through Mary or through Joseph, he was a son of David. Messiah had to be a son of David. True or false? True. If he is a son of David, why does David call him Lord? And we know it's all taken from Psalm 110. But let's start unravelling the wonder of the Master's answer in Psalm 110. Verse 1, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand, sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. The Lord shall send the rod of thy strength out of Zion, rule thou in the midst of thy enemies. Thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power, in the beauties of holiness, from the womb of the morning thou hast the dew of thy youth. The Lord has sworn and will not repent. Thou art the priest for ever after the order of Melchizedek. The Lord at thy right hand shall strike through kings in the day of his wrath. He shall judge among the heathen, he shall fill the places with the dead bodies, he shall wound the heads over many countries, he shall drink of the brook in the way, therefore shall he lift up the head. Probably the most beautiful of all the Psalms, and certainly the most complex if we dissect it to the nth degree. We want to try and think of it in the context of what the master is saying. What were they trying to do to him? Put him to death. They want to deliver him to the governor. You've seen that earlier tonight. If he was the Messiah, he would be the son of David, because that was what was promised. Where was it promised? 2 Samuel 7. Let's go back to 2 Samuel 7. Because we want to see 2 Samuel 6, 2 Samuel 7, and 2 Samuel 8 in the context of Psalm 110. 2 Samuel 6, first of all, is the bringing of the ark to Zion. We know the error of Uzzah, and we know that it abode in the house of Obed-Edom for 3 months, and then David, by having it carried upon the shoulders of the Kohathites, brought it to Zion. And verse 17 of 2 Samuel 6, and they brought in the ark of the Lord and set it in his place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had pitched for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord. And as soon as David had made an end of offering burnt offerings and peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord. What was David performing there? The office of a priest. Now, he was not a priest after the order of Levi, because he was a king of Judah. Now, when another king of Judah, later on, Uzziah, tried to perform the office of a priest as well as a king, he was smitten with leprosy. David wasn't. Why? Read on verse 19. And he dealt among all the people, even among all the whole multitude of Israel, as well as to the women as to the men, to every one a cake of bread and a good piece of flesh and a flagon of wine. So all the people departed, every one to his house. So he offered to the people bread and wine. Who offered to whom bread and wine? Abraham with Melchizedek in Genesis 14. Keep your finger there, just go back to Genesis 14. What? Genesis 14, quickly. Give you something to think about, and we'll pick it up next time, God willing. Genesis 14, verse 18. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. He was the priest of the Most High God. So for David to perform what he did in 2 Samuel 6, the ark representing the very presence of God, he was performing the office of a priest after the order of Melchizedek. And he offered bread and wine. 2 Samuel 7. 2 Samuel 7 is the promise that of the son of David, God would raise up the Messiah to Israel. Verse 14, I will be his father, he shall be my son. What was David commanded to do? Verse 18, then King David went in and sat before the Lord. Sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool.
And this will be continued at our next session.